What's up, ODs and eyewear lovers? We're talking the latest trends in tech and eye care, so sit back, relax, and defocus.
Greetings, colleagues, and welcome to the Defocus Media Podcast. My name is Daryl.
And it's Jen.
And today we have a very special guest. This gentleman has created a brand synonymous with stars and style and created a platform for all eyewear designers. You have seen his eyewear on the likes of Audrey Hepburn, Princess Diana, and Michael Caine, just to name a few. Friends, I'd like to introduce my friend and living eyewear legend, Sir Oliver Goldsmith. How are you doing today, sir?
Yeah, doing fine, thanks. It's quite an exciting day for me because my daughter-in-law had a baby boy, which makes it number 7 in our family. So very exciting day. But I'm really happy to be talking to you guys now.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
So we want to hear about yourself. Tell us, who is Sir Oliver Goldsmith and what's the story behind the brand?
Okay. Oliver Goldsmith was initially my grandfather. His name was Philip Oliver Goldsmith. And he started the company in 1926, having been a sales representative for another English company. And his boss said to him when he was giving in his notice, Phil, do yourself a favor, call your company Oliver Goldsmith, because people will remember the name because there was an Irish poet who came to live in London, and it'll last in people's memories longer than Philip O. Goldsmith and Company. So he set the company up as P. Oliver Goldsmith Limited, and it was launched in Soho in London. And for any of you guys who know London, it's just off of Oxford Street. And he had a workshop on the top floor of a six-story building. And he gathered together some craftsmen, and his speciality was to make real tortoiseshell spectacle frames. He wanted to be different to everybody else, and real tortoiseshell, in the days when it was allowed, was the most comfortable frame you could wear. Following on from my grandfather, my father came into the business in 1936, and he didn't have Oliver in his name because when he was born, my grandfather didn't have any reason to think that he would have a very well-known company in the making. And unfortunately, my grandfather died very suddenly at the age of 56 from a heart attack. And as we say in England, when a member of royalty dies, the Queen is dead. God save the Queen, or God save the King, depending on who's coming next. So what happened in that case with my grandfather was Oliver Goldsmith is dead. Long live Oliver Goldsmith. And my father assumed the name Oliver Goldsmith and dropped the first name of Charles. When I was born, my father had the foresight to incorporate Oliver as a middle name. And my full name is Andrew Oliver Goldsmith. That's how that started. And I'll come back to me in a minute. And when my children were born, my firstborn was my daughter, and she was named Alexandra Olivia Goldsmith, and my first son was named Nicholas Oliver Goldsmith. And my children have also, in the Goldsmith side of the family, and even in my daughter's side of the family, they are taking the middle name of Oliver for at least one member of the family, which is very satisfying for me and exciting because it means that there are future generations, fourth and fifth, well, that's fifth and sixth in the making, but they don't realize it at the moment. with me, what happened is this. I was a failed architect. Couldn't get my buildings to stand up. And, well, One building which I claim fame for is in Italy called the Tower of Pisa.
Sir Oliver Goldsmith, you're a trip, man. It leads quite a bit.
So the School of Architecture suggested to me it would be better for me to concentrate on designing something smaller. And so I approached my father because in the 50s, it was normal for the children to go into the family business. It was just the known thing. But my father didn't want to persuade either myself or my brother to go in unless we wanted to. So when I approached him at the age of 18 and said, look, I'd like to join the company and be a designer, he was very happy for me to do that. But when I got to work the first day, he said to me, you won't touch paper with a pencil for 5 years. And I said, well, what do you mean? I've come here as a designer. He said, well, first of all, you've got to get the respect of my staff. You can't come in here at 18 and start telling my staff what to do because I'll have a revolt on my hands. And so I said, okay, what's my first job? And he said, well, first job is you clean the toilets, sweep the floors, make the tea, and generally be helpful so they can see that, that you're not the boss's son who doesn't have to do anything menial. And with hindsight, it was all very, very good basic training for me. And I did my 5 years. I even learned how to make a frame. And unfortunately, I've forgotten that now because it's so long ago. But it was all very good grounding. So when eventually I was employing staff and they moaned at me about this, that, or the other, I could say, look, seen it, been there, done it. Don't give me all this hassle. Just get on and do your job. And that's what it's about. I'm the third generation. Now, with the fourth generation, it's quite complicated because there are actually three fourth generation goldsmiths around. One you know is Claire, my niece, Claire Goldsmith. And yes. Then there's also my daughter, Alexandra Olivia Goldsmith, who works with me part-time because she's a professional photographer. But she's heavily involved with me at the trade shows in Europe. And she'll take over my business when I'm no longer around or I can't do it. My eldest son, who I mentioned earlier, Nicholas Oliver Goldsmith, is the design consultant to the OGX collection, which we're going to discuss later, in Japan. So in essence, there are three fourth generations. But I'd rather just concentrate on me because I'm alive and kicking, and really it's all about the third. Well, you know, I like to feel that I'm still here, that I'm not giving up my role as Oliver Goldsmith at this point. So
we wouldn't have it any other way, so no worry.
Not.
Thank you, Daryl. You're so kind. So that's the story behind the name and where we are.
So with the Oliver Goldsmith brand, there's always six letters I see associated with the brand. HHSQEC. What do these letters mean and how did they come about?
I don't sell spectacle frames. And people look at me in amazement and horror. What do you mean you don't sell spectacle frames? You're sitting here at an optical trade show and we're surrounded by frames. And I explain to them, I sell these letters, which translate into HHS, translates into history, heritage, story. And QEC relates to the quality, the elegance, and the comfort. So now to explain those. History is because we've been around 90 years, and we're going to talk about that a bit later. Heritage is because the brand name has survived the 90 years, which is in this day and age actually is quite amazing. And the story is what I'm here to tell everybody, and it's what I spend most of my time doing now because my side of the business, the optical side of the business, is licensed to two companies, one in England and one in Japan. And basically, I just travel to various parts of the world to do media interviews and talk about the history of the company because I know what it's all about. I know it all. QEC is even more interesting because in 1965, when my father said, you can start designing now because it's the swinging 60s in London, and we were right bang in the center of Soho, which was where all the young people were, the young designers were hanging out and all the magazines were about. And he said, I want you to remember three words which come down to the letters QEC. When you start designing, remember only to make quality frames, make the frames elegant, never make a woman look stupid in glasses, because in the 60s, a lot of women didn't want to wear glasses. They wear sunglasses, but they didn't want to wear spectacles. And C, make the frames comfortable for two reasons. One, so that the optician doesn't have the customer coming back every 5 minutes complaining that they're hurting behind the ears, they're hurting on the nose, and also that the customer can say to their friends, wow, these Oliver Goldsmith frames are so comfortable, I wouldn't have anything else. So that's exactly what I explain to any new clients that come to see me at the trade shows. I always explain to them those six letters. And I say to them, if you buy in to my words, you can have the frames. If there's anything in my words you don't like or don't want, then my collection's not for you. And 9 times out of 10, they buy in because they love the whole thing. They love the story. And I've had a lot of feedback saying, I've told your story to the customers and they love it, and that's what it's all about. So we pushed on a bit there as well, because what I do now, if an optician would like me to write a thank you letter to their customer, I will do that willingly from London, and it'll go by post. Now, in the USA and Canada, we have to write care of the optician because we're not allowed to write directly to the customer's home address. But in Europe, we can. There's no problem writing to the customers directly. And I've had so many lovely comments come back to me on Facebook saying, I received this beautiful, wonderful letter from Oliver Goldsmith in London thanking me for buying his frame. Now, where does that happen? It certainly doesn't happen in the optical industry, and I don't think it happens in the fashion industry, to be honest with you. So it's just a little added extra that I give to help push my brand, because we're in a very competitive business, optics and sunglasses. And every day you look on the net and you see someone new is trying to get in, and it's very, very difficult. So if you're established and want to remain in the forefront of the people's eyes, you've got to keep pushing. So that's why the QEC is so important.
So I was really taken by your description of designing eyewear in the swinging 60s. What was the first frame that you did in that time period that you designed that you were like, man, this is it. This is my iconic contribution.
Right. Well, that's very simple. I was trying to be clever. And most frames have a bump on the bridge, an outward bump. It curves out. So I said, right, no bump, I'm leaving it flat. The sides were always at the top of the frame. I said, right, let's move them down to the middle. And let's make the weight of the frame a little heavier than all these very, very thin, what we call English National Health Service frames, which are very thin. And the name of the frame was RIP, R-I-P. Now, it doesn't mean rest in peace. I don't know what it, I think it came from an American cowboy film. It must have been some American cowboy film where one of the cowboys was called Rip. And I must have got it from there, because everybody says to me, oh, that means rest in peace. And I go, well, not actually. Anyway, that was my first design. It was put on display in my father's showroom. And he had a visitor came to see him to buy some new frames. And his name was Lord Snowden. And Lord Snowden was married to Princess Margaret around in the 1960s. And would you believe that the frame that he chose for his own use was my frame? Out of all the frames on display, which were my father's, hundreds of them, he zeroed in on my frame, the Rip. And that made me feel very, very, very happy. My father wasn't upset because it was publicity for the company. And we made the glasses up for him. And then he was seen photographed in all the newspapers judging a contest for something or other. And that's how it really started. And then it leads on to film companies and things.
So this is where the fashion and eyewear started to take place or birth?
Yes, because what was happening is that after the Second World War, spectacle frames were considered a medical necessity for several reasons. One, nobody had any money to spend on lashing out on something expensive. And the colors weren't available from the material manufacturers because everyone was just getting back into their step. And my father realized that to make a name for himself, he had to have something fashionable. And he had to be able to go to the magazines such as Vogue and show them something startling that they would say, oh, let's feature this for you. And my father probably was the first person in the UK anyway to instigate fashion and turn a medical necessity into a fashion accessory. So that is very important, and I'm very proud of my father for that. And he came up with some really what I would consider weird designs, which he did because he needed the publicity, and it's what Vogue found so interesting. And then I can let you in on something I'm working on. I've taken three of my father's designs, and I'm working with a 3D printing company. And what we're doing is we're going to turn 20th century designs into 21st century technology.
Oh, wow.
It won't just be a normal frame. It's going to be something so special that your eyes are going to pop, and then you're going to say to me, Daryl and Jen, wow, we're going to have to do another interview on these, because
most definitely.
So I'm working on it, but I'm allowing it to take its time, because I want it to be absolutely right, and I have to convince my licensees that I want to do this, because this is the future. It's not for everything. I don't think everything has to be in 3D print, but designs that can't be made on machine or by machine, which can only be done in 3D printing, will give me a lot of publicity and just show that we are at the forefront, that we're not sitting on our laurels saying, oh, well, that's the 60s design, 60s, 50s design, that's what you're going to have. We're saying, no, we're going to do things to it to make it 21st century and make it very, very viable and desirable to the public to want to buy them. So the thing here is, watch this space. I can't say more than that at the moment, because it's work in progress at the moment. And but I'm very, very excited about it. I've seen the prototypes, and it's just amazing what can be done. But you've got to work with the right people. It's not just saying, oh, well, just show that frame to a 3D printer machine and it'll do it. There's a lot more involved than that. But it's very exciting, and we've got to test the market as well. We've got to make sure it works, that it's sturdy, and the pits don't fall off. But once I've got it and it's working, you guys will be the first to see it, I promise you.
Thank you so much. You know, it seems like you're always on the cutting edge of technology. I mean, even your OGX collection, you have titanium nose pads. I've never seen that before until I saw your collection. Can you tell us more about that OGX collection?
OGX, very, very interesting. When I started in Japan in 2002, the Japanese came. I'd met this Japanese guy, Takanori Yoshida, at a trade show in Milan. He was introduced to me by an Australian salesman, optical salesman, and we got talking. We got on very well, and nothing happened for a year or two. And then he said to me, "Retro is about to start in Japan." This was in 2002, and I would love to be your licensee and to remake your designs, because you told me at various meetings that you have over 600 designs in your archive, which you can re-release. And I said, well, yes, of course I do, Tak. You can come over with pleasure, and it'd be very nice to get into the Japanese market. And he said to me, well, you realize you're going to have to come over several times a year to promote, because the English look and the English people and the English speaking is something that they love over here. And and I said, no, I'm happy to do that, because it was a country that I wanted to visit so often. And so we put together the first collection, which was called OGOG, Oliver Goldsmith Original and Genuine Spectacle Frames. And these were all basically the heavy plastics, or Xyle as you call them, and we launched those. And the personalities that wore them, which created the instant success in Japan, was Michael Caine, and I'll explain the story with that later. Peter Sellers were the two main gentlemen that wore my glasses, and the Japanese loved that. And so that's how it sort of got started. And then I went over to Tokyo to do a promotion. And one of the things was that they had me usually for 2 weeks at a time. And then they'd say, right, 6 o'clock, we leave the hotel at 6 o'clock in the morning to go to the next town and do the promotion, blah, 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 blah. And we'll have dinner with the local people, and you'll get to sample all the different types of food that we eat in Japan. Little was I to know what was coming my way. I think the hilarious experience for me for the first visit was, when I landed, we went to this very famous Japanese restaurant, sushi restaurant, and they brought this whole fish to the table. And the head was on and the tail was on, and there were two metal prongs holding the fish upright. But there was nothing between the head and the tail. All the meat of the fish was lined up in cubes by the fish's mouth. And my licensee said to me, eat, eat, eat. So I pick up the chopsticks, and I pick up a piece of fish. And as I'm putting it in my mouth, the fish's mouth goes open and closed. You're like,
oh, my gosh.
Oh, my God, it's alive. It's alive. I got, what's going on here? What's going on? And he explained to me that the nervous system in a fish carries on for 30 minutes after it's cut up.
Oh, wow.
Okay? Extremely fresh.
Yes. So I then asked the stupid question. Did they kill it before they cut it up, or did they cut it up while it was alive? And the answer was, sorry, not an answer. And I realized then the fish had been cut up alive.
Yeah.
And that was one experience which it was good in the end. You know what I mean? I just took the attitude, look, when in Japan, do as the Japanese do. You mustn't refuse the food, because that's an insult to them. And it's important to keep saying thank you, thank you, and drink lots of sake to drown your sorrows, which is how I got addicted to sake. Japanese rice wine, which I love, and it goes down a treat. You don't get drunk with it. You get very mellow, which is exactly what I needed. So, backwards and forwards, four times a year to Japan from 2002 to 2012. I think the customs officers got so used to me, they just waved me through because they knew who I was. And I loved it. I loved every minute of it. And in fact, because of Japan, there was a story that my father had the foresight to make sunglasses for Princess Diana, which was he made them just before she announced her engagement to Prince Charles, because he realized there was... a publicity opportunity because she was going to go to Australia to just discuss it with her mother before she made the decision to say yes. And my father thought, well, if she's wearing Oliver Goldsmith sunglasses, then that would be absolutely fantastic. And what happened is he sent two pairs, but they arrived a little late for her departure. But he had a handwritten letter from her when she got back to say, thank you so much for the sunglasses. I'm sorry they didn't arrive in time, but I shall be wearing them from now on because I've got engaged to Prince Charles, and the media are going to be following me everywhere, so I'm going to need dark sunglasses. And we became her main supplier of sunglasses, not the only supplier, but the main supplier. And she would, her lady in waiting would let me know, because I took it over from my father in the 60s, and then it would let me know what colors clothing she was wearing on various overseas trips. And then I would make the sunglasses in toning colors to go with the outfit, so everything looked done completely right. Now, this is an I always asked to see Princess Diana, and they always said to me, no, it's not. She's very busy, and the glasses fit so well, it's not necessary for you to have an appointment to see her. And on one of my trips coming home from Japan, I got to Narita Airport and I saw masses and masses of photographers. And stupidly, I thought they were there for me, but they weren't. So I said to them, who's so important on the flight? And they said, Princess Diana. I went, no way. And she was there on a private visit for the Red Cross. And... fortunately, because the Japanese were paying, I was flying business class back to London, and she was also up in the business class. They took the first six rows on the upper deck, and with her bodyguards and makeup and hair and the guy that carries the bag and the briefcase and all the various things. And and I'm sitting in the first row of the second section next to the doors, and sitting next to me was the managing director of Suzuki Motorbike Racing. And I said, oh, I make all her sunglasses. He said, yeah, they all say that. So he said, go on, go and talk to her. So I said, well, I have a few sakis and a few gin and tonics, and I probably will. So then I went to the restroom, and I looked in the mirror, and I said, Oliver, if you don't speak to her now, you're never going to speak to her. So I had my business card in my pocket. I came out of the restroom. I leaned across the lady in waiting. Bodyguards were a bit dubious. And I said, excuse me, ma'am, but my name's Oliver Goldsmith, and I make all your sunglasses. And she looked at the card, and her eyelids fluttered. And she said, oh, yes, of course you do. At which moment in time, I thought the lady in waiting was going to say, Mr. Goldsmith, have my seat and talk to the princess, but she didn't. So what felt like 2 hours was probably 10 or 15 seconds. And I said, well, it was a pleasure to meet you. And then I went back to my seat. And the guy said to me, Suzuki, I said, well, you really do, don't you? And then about half an hour later, a lady came from further back, leaned over my seat and said, how did you have the nerve to talk to Princess Diana? So I looked around and I said, oh, she's a family friend. She comes for tea every Sunday. So that was my experience of actually meeting Princess Diana.
So roughly how long have you been in business for?
I've been in, well, the company has been in business this year, 90 years this year in September. And I've been in 57 years. It's the only job I've ever had, and I've really enjoyed it. I have no regrets. What we decided is that we wanted to put out one special frame. Now, the frame, which is called President, is the design that Michael Caine wore. And the significance with that is that that was the first frame I designed for a film company. So I'm going to have to just go backwards a bit in time. A film company approached me, and they needed some dark black glasses for Michael Caine to wear in the film called The Ypres File, in which his namesake was called Harry Palmer. And basically, he had to bring a secret message out of East Germany into West Germany without the border police finding it. So I sat down for weeks trying to think, what could I design that he could use and get a message out? So I came up with an idea for a frame with a triangular side. And instead of putting the core wire in the side, we would make the hole bigger. And then I explained to the film company, he would roll up the secret message on rice paper, slide it into the side, and then he could wear the frame and he'd go through the border police without being caught. I thought it was brilliant. The film company thought it was brilliant. Michael Caine put the frame on, his face fell down on his chest because it was so heavy. And he said, I just can't wear this. It's just too heavy. So they said, well, we're going to have to come up with a different idea. So I went back to the drawing board and came up with the frame called President. And that's the one he wore in the Ypres File. And so I thought, well, as he made that famous from that time and also gave me my first touch into film work, because more films followed, I thought, well, let's use that frame. So what I've done is we've taken the frame and we've slotted into the front, the thickness of the front, the 8mm of the front, a metal bar that's gone across the across the top of the front, inset into the plastic, which is first coated in palladium and then 18-karat gold plated. It's made in a new color from Mazzucchelli called Dense Black. Normally, you make black material from all the offcuts and the rubbish that's left over, and you just put black dye in. With this color, Dense Black, it's actually made from scratch. So there's no what are called scrap plastic in it. It's all brand new, created for this frame. And it's a much deeper black, although black is black, but it's a much deeper black. And then we've also put the metal in the width of the sides. So when you look down on the top of the sides, you can see the gold as well. There are only 90 pieces made, which will be available in middle to end of September. And each frame is numbered, 1 over 90 to 90 over 90. Every frame comes with a certificate of authenticity, also numbered with, please God, the same number, as long as they package it right. And then it has its own special case, cleaning cloth, and a presentation box. Now, the idea that I've put to the opticians is that they buy this not so much to sell, but to have as a collector's item in their store. Because in a few years' time, Japanese collectors will be driving themselves potty to get hold of one, and they'll pay through the nose for it. But some opticians have said to me, no, I'll have two. I'll have one for the store, and I'm going to sell one, or I'm going to wear one. So the sales are going very well, actually. I think we've sold, of the 90, I think we've sold about 60 already. So there aren't many left. So if any of your listeners are interested, they should get in touch pretty quick, because there won't be many left. And when they're gone, they're gone. So that's the story behind the 90th anniversary frame. And then the next one to come will be, please God, when the company's 100 years old. But my niece and I are planning to launch a book for that one, for the 100th, a nice coffee table book in gloss color, with lots of stories, lots of photos, and basically lots of interesting things for the opticians to keep. But that's 10 years on, so let's not worry about that now. Let's get the 90th off the ground, which it is off the ground, but I'm very excited about that. And I told you who wore it.
Do you have a favorite collection that you've designed so far?
Honestly, my favorite collection would be my 1960s collection when I first started, because it was all so exciting that I was creating and people were buying. I had no idea that retro was going to come back in 50 years' time, but that would be my most exciting period of design, because everything was happening. And I basically worked in plastic as aisle, because that was our workshop was designed to make plastic. My father and I did design some metal frames, which we've been adding to the collection, mainly his designs actually. But then he had to get those made outside of our workshop because we didn't have the metal facility to do it. But what we're doing now is that I'm beginning to incorporate some modern frames with the retro frames, because retro won't last forever, and I want to make sure that we're here with the right product mix of product. So we've got retro and modern, and it's working. You know, the opticians, our customers like that. There's a choice, and which leads me on to the OG. How did the OGX collection come about? OGX, my Japanese licensee, the guy in charge of the sales in Japan, very, very talented young man. And he said to me, through interpreters, because he doesn't speak any English, he said, look, I would like to create the OGX collection with your approval of all the designs, but I know what the Japanese want. And from our point of view, it would be better if we did what we know will sell than you saying, oh no, I want to do this, I want to do that. Now, I'm not stupid enough to say I know everything, because nobody knows everything. And anybody who says I know everything should be shot, because you learn something new every day. And consequently, I said, okay, but I must see all the designs, the drawings first and the samples before you go to production. Yes, no problem. And it was an English expression, the best thing since sliced bread, because it's taken off like crazy. And as you just mentioned earlier, Daryl, the whole frame is titanium, including the nose pads. And they wanted it all to be titanium for several reasons. One, because of the light weight. Two, the nose pads don't tarnish, whereas with the plastic or the silicone, you know, over time, they tend to get a bit of green on them from the sweat on the face. And the frame details are printed on the top of the rim, the top of the frame rim, which is very unusual, but you don't see it when you're wearing it, but it's there. And that's how the Japanese interpreted how they wanted to do it. So they launched basically three collections a year, not many. You know, they only launched 4-5 pieces. The opticians in Japan, they don't keep demanding new frames all the time. They're happy to rebuy what they've had.
Why do you think Japan has been such a huge market for you?
Because the Japanese are so stylish and so fashion conscious. You have to bear in mind that retro hadn't hit Europe or America in 2002. We were still playing around with regular looking frames. The Japanese have foresight to see what's coming before anybody else. And they're so fastidious about the quality, and everything has to be absolutely perfect, that they just get on the bandwagon early, which for me was very satisfying, because I was getting royalty, and I was working hard because of the trips were quite exhausting, but I made a lot of friends in Japan, and I still have all those friends now. And you know, every time I go back, I don't go as often. I go once a year now, because I have to respect my age. I'm not old, but I'm not as sprightly as I used to be.
What are you now, about 21 or what?
Well, in my mind, I'm 53. And in reality, I'm 73. Where I used to better run after young women, now I crawl.
Oh.
No, the hardest thing for me is, because I'm a bit of a flirt, I admit, and especially with young women. And they look at me and they go, Grandpa, forget it. So I don't get a look in. Dream on, they say. Dream on. I say, yeah, but I'm only 53 in my mind. It doesn't matter. You're 73 and you're old enough to be my father, let alone my grandfather. So anyway, but I enjoy life, and that's what it's about. I I made a decision. Well, I didn't make a decision. My father made a decision for me, because you probably won't believe that I was an introvert. And when I went in, and just going back to 1965, when my father allowed me to design, I was very introvert. I was Andrew, and I was quite introvert. And my father said, Oliver Gosden has to be extrovert. You can't, you know, it won't work being an introvert. And he packed me off to New York to somebody, to a guy, an English guy that he knew living in New York, and said to him, train him. And I spent 3 weeks with this guy, and he trained me to get out of my shell. So when I came back, my mother, who was quite worried about the Jekyll and Hyde situation, but she called me Andrew, obviously. Hang on a minute. You're going to see your uncle, who is the chief psychiatrist in Great Britain, to make an assessment before you can call yourself Oliver. So I trundled down to see my uncle, and he sat me down. He said to me, okay, who's Andrew? So I said, well, Andrew's a married man at the time with two children, very happy, never looks at another woman, buried in his work, blah, 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 quite boring, really. And he said, okay, who's Oliver? Oh, I said, Oliver's a different kettle of fish. Oliver is not married, not interested in getting married, adores women, rather be in the company of women than men, doesn't want to go to the bar with the men and drink beer, oogling at women saying, oh, yeah, that one. I'd rather sit with the women in a wine bar and have a sensible conversation. So he said to me, okay, I'll tell your mother there's no problem, which he did. And basically, there hasn't been any problem. I have developed into Oliver more than Andrew. Over the years, because of my work, but certain people still call me, but, you know, close friends and family still call me Andrew. My wife still calls me Andrew, and business associates now realize that I do have two names, so they're very nice about it, and they respond to either Andrew or Oliver. In essence, I prefer Oliver. That's who I really am. You know, basically, I love women. That's all there is to it. I can't help it. I'd rather be in women's company. Sorry, Daryl, don't mean you.
I'm the same way, so no worries.
Okay.
So for your son, Nick Oliver, are you putting him through similar training on how to become just Oliver?
No, because Nick is a film producer. Did you ever get in America The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy?
Yeah, I loved it.
Well, he made that.
Oh, wow.
He was the producer on that film. It was a film for Disney. It was funded by Disney.
Speaking more about your design again, when you were designing for films, do you feel like you have to do a different process than when you design for everyday spectacle wear?
Yes, because up until 1989, we were one company. The sunglass company and the optical company was all one. And my father was in charge. But my father couldn't control his two sons. And we were always bickering and couldn't get on. And in 1989, we decided that we had to split the company. So up until then, it was all one company. So I can talk about the sunglasses up to 1989 because I was physically involved. After doing the Ibcrest file, the same film company came back to me and said, right, his next film is called Funeral in Berlin, and we need different glasses for that one. So I created another frame, which was called the Counselor, which is from the Japanese collection, and which is from the Japanese collection now. It was obviously from my collection in England originally. That frame, the distinctive thing about the frame, it had a wraparound lug and six pins showing on the side where the joints were pinned through. We didn't have pinless joints in those days. And you can clearly see the three pins on the wraparound of the lug and on the side. And that was the other film that I made for. I never met him because I made frames that fit and they fitted him, so it wasn't a problem. And then another film company got in touch with me who was making Audrey Hepburn's Two for the Road. And the brief from them was they needed a huge, huge wraparound sunglass. Now, you have to bear in mind, in the 70s, we didn't have access to CR39, not easily anyway. A huge wrap sunglass was like virtually impossible because you couldn't get the lenses. So I designed the sunglass for her to wear, and literally that the lenses came round to just before her ear. So the side piece was very, very short. It just went over the ear to hold it in place. And what we had to do is we had to cut up some colored plastic and cut them to fit into the frame. And then when we realized there was potential for this sunglass to sell, the film company gave us permission to sell it. It wasn't one that they paid for. You know, I tended to avoid that because I wanted to be able to use the frames that I designed. And in those days, that was fine. And what we did in the end is I went to a company in France to get it molded. We didn't have any molding facilities in the UK. So I went to France, to the Oyonnax region where all the plastics are made. And I was able to get it molded. And then they were able to get the lenses made specially for the frame in France. And it was a huge success. And it was called Yuhu, Y-U-H-U.
Who's in charge of the sunglasses section now? It seems like you do a lot with the ophthalmic division of Oliver Goldsmith.
Right. Well, I'm in charge. I run the ophthalmic, the spectacle frame side of the business. Claire Goldsmith runs the sunglass side of Oliver Goldsmith. And all the Oliver Goldsmith sunglasses are my designs. So when she set it up in 2004, I gave her all the designs. And she's done a very good job. She's a fantastic marketing person. And she's got us lots and lots of publicity. So we run parallel. We don't run as one company for many reasons, but we run parallel.
So one thing that always grabs my attention about the Oliver Goldsmith brand are the names of the frames. What's the thought process in regards to naming your eyewear?
Well, most of the names are from people I've met, especially women, obviously. And it's an amazing thing when you say to a lady, can I have your permission to name a frame after you? And they go all like jelly. Really? You want to name one after me? Yeah, of course you can. And that's what happens is that I name them after people that I've met that I've met. With the men, it's more difficult, although I have met, because when I was in doing a tour of California, met a lot of male opticians and I picked up names. I'm sorry, I haven't used your name yet, Daryl, but we will.
Oh, man, that'd be amazing. I wouldn't even know what to do it myself. I'm looking forward to it.
I volunteer Daryl's wife. She's got a really good name for a frame.
And how about you, Jen? Should we use Jen?
Jen is very boring. I would just go, you can spice it up somehow.
Okay, I'll work on it. So, yes, in the early days, I used to get an atlas out and go through the atlas looking for names that sounded interesting. And there are a lot of names. When you look at an atlas carefully, you can find lots of names. But now, in the last 10, 12 years, I decided to use names of people I've met, because then it brings back the story of who they were, what they were doing. And one particular frame we've got in the collection called Zoom. People say, well, how did that come about? And I said, well, I was at this optician's in Beverly Hills, and this little kid came in with his mother, and they were very well to do, apparently, and the kid's name was Zoom. So I wrote it down, and I bought a frame out called Zoom. And then Dwayne was, because people always say, well, where do you get Dwayne from? Well, he was the optician at this optometrist in Beverly Hills. So we got permission to call it after him, and that frame is out now. So yes, that's basically how I find the names now is using, because you see, because I'm Oliver Goldsmith, I can change the names from the past. You know, there's one frame that's going to come out in the next 12 months called it was called Miss Dexter. My father called it Miss Dexter. It was obviously named after a lady that he knew from one of the magazines, and it's now going to be called Sima, S-I-M-A. And she was an air stewardess that I met on British Airways coming back from New York, who was very helpful to me, making sure I drank lots of water. And I said, can I name a frame? She wore glasses, actually. And I said, can I name a frame after you? She said, really? You know, as they do. And I said, yeah, absolutely. Showed her the design that I had in mind. She said, absolutely. Let me know when it's out and I'll buy a pair. I said, well, I'll probably better get you a pair because it's got your name on it. So, yes, this makes a lot of people happy. And in England, I've got opticians who, like Jess, Jessica, which we named the frame Jess because she prefers the shortened version. That frame's coming out for Silmo. And she's over the moon. It's got her name on it. And, you know, it just makes people happy. And that's what it's all about. I mean, business has got to be happy, fun, as well as business-like.
What's the story behind the why not? My wife loves that frame. She wears it every single day.
Oh, why not?
Yes.
Well, the story behind that one, I designed it, you know, with a flat top and a curved bottom. And in those days, I had to show my father everything to get approval. And he just looked at it and went, why not?
Okay.
And so I said, okay, should we call it why not then? So he said, yeah, let's call it why not. That's what I said, he said. So, yes, it's a particular. It's quite a particular design. It's part of the heavier collection that I used to do in those days, bolder looking.
So who was the most famous celebrity or person to wear your eyeglasses?
There were two, actually. In the 50s, there was an English actress just starting out called Diana Dawes. Now, you won't know who she is because she's English. And she was being promoted as a starlet. And my father made her a pair of very unusual sunglasses where the sides came out from the nose, not from the lug of the frame. And she was photographed in Cannes at the Cannes Film Festival wearing them. And he got a lot of publicity from that. But more important is the next one I'm going to mention, because you do know her in America, Princess Grace of Monaco. Right. My father had the honor to make 45 pairs of glasses for her. And wow. He even went to the palace to see her in Monaco. And when it was my turn, I went to see her at the a hotel. She always stayed at the hotel called the Connaught Hotel in London. And I went to see her there once with all the latest collections. So she was a very, very great person. And she instigated the wardrobe of glasses. Because she said to my father, look, I think women should have a wardrobe of glasses, like they have a wardrobe of shoes, wardrobe of clothes, because you shouldn't wear the same glasses with every outfit. You wouldn't wear the same clothes to a funeral as you'd wear to a wedding. So why do you wear the same glasses to those two events? And she was very happy to help promote that idea, which is quite strange because royalty don't normally get involved, even though she was an actress, but she married royalty, so she became royalty. And she even allowed my father to put a little plaque in front of the frames that she had chosen, which read, as chosen by Her Serene Highness Princess Grace of Monaco. Now, you would never get any royals to do that today. So that was a first, actually. And she was very, very helpful in getting off the ground this idea of a wardrobe of glasses. So that would be our most famous person who is known everywhere, and especially in the States. So she's very important. And then John Lennon, I didn't supply John Lennon. He went to an optician and bought a pair of my metal glasses, which I only found out about, a lot of years later, when the frame came up for auction of Beatles memorabilia. What had happened is that the screw had come out of the side, and when you're rich, you don't bother to go back to the optician to get a new screw fitted. You throw it in the trash can. And the cleaning lady took it and kept it. And then when this auction was going on for Beatles memorabilia, she took it out and she put it into the auction, and it sold for $3,500.
Wow.
So that was my introduction to John Lennon. Apart from Princess Diana, Lord Snowden, Nancy Sinatra wore my winter sunglasses. I had sunglasses of very pale tints. She wore those. Just trying to think who else there was. Yes, Peter Sellers. He was another great, great friend of my father's. And he wore a design called Vice Consul from my Japanese collection. And he wore it outside of film work, so his regular work. Regular, when he had to wear prescription lenses. During the films, he didn't bother. I think he wore contact lenses. Unfortunately, all the names are... I can't remember all the names now. Oh, Lulu. These are English singers who you wouldn't know. Lulu, Dusty Springfield. They're all, way beyond your time. What I did in the end, I decided in the end that there was no point in just making the famous people, because the public at large was saying, well, we can't afford it because he's making for the royalty, the royals and the film people and everything else. They've got loads and loads of money. We can't afford it. So I thought, you're right. Let's make the public at large my famous people, because without them, I don't earn an income. And it's more important to have them on board than worrying too much about saying, oh, well, we supply this famous person, that famous person. I mean, it's very nice to be able to have all the famous people, but there's one recent one on the optical side that came about last week. An optician dispensed one of my frames to a guy called Gary Lineker. Are you into football, Daryl? English football?
No, I'm a basketball guy, NBA, college basketball.
No, okay. So you wouldn't know who he is, but he's got about 3 million followers.
Oh, wow.
He allowed us to put his picture up on Facebook, on my Facebook page, Oliver Goldsmith Spectacles. And within 5 days, we'd had 1,200 hits, which I've never had that many hits. And it's been fantastic.
Speaking of social media, how have you adapted to the world of social media?
Very hard. You know, so it took me 3 years to learn how to switch the computer on. So that was hard enough. So what I do with social media is my grandson looks after Facebook and my granddaughter looks after Instagram. So I just send them what I want put up and they get it up and they take care of it for me because I'm pretty useless with all those things. And it's a money earner for them because they get paid to do it. So money counts, money pays. So I'm happy for them to do it. I love social media. I'm on it every single day looking to see who's blogging and liking other people and seeing what's going on. It's the future. You know, it's a very important, as much as a lot of people think, oh, God, it's nothing, don't bother. The only one I don't do Twitter because I don't want to get involved with writing lots of rubbish and then having people writing back rubbish. So I use Facebook and Instagram, but I only use it for work. I don't put on this. I don't put up, like some people put up, what shall I have for dinner tonight? Like, I care, you know?
So probably not Snapchat for you then.
No. The two is enough. The two that I mentioned, Facebook and Instagram, are enough for me.
So with Vision Expo West and Simo around the corner, do you have anything special in store for us eyewear connoisseurs?
Well, we've got new designs coming for one of the problems we've got with all these shows come too close to each other. We're gearing up for Silmo, and then Vision Expo West is the week before.
Right.
Which makes it difficult because we're always behind on getting everything ready, as most manufacturers are. And so half of the new designs will be in Vegas, including the 90th anniversary frame should be there. And there'll be some other designs there as well. And then the balance will be at Silmo. Now, in Las Vegas, we distribute all my frames, all the oligos and optical frames will be shown on the Prism Optical booth, which is in the Venetian Hotel on floor 36 in suite 115. And I won't be there this year because I had a DVT on the way back last year, and it sort of worried me. The 10-hour flight worried me. And then it was coming home for 3 days and then going straight off to Paris for another 5 days. So I'm not doing Vegas this year as much as I'm upset about it. But the staff there will be taking good care because they all love Oliver Goldsmith and the frames, not me. And they'll have all the frames there. And in fact, one of the frames called Denise, Denise is there, who's the representative from Vancouver, and she can't wait to show it because it's got her name on it. And the other frame that will be there is called Rock, R-O-C-K, which is named after Christina Rock. And then at Silmo, I have a nice big booth there, which is all black, like my suit, black and white. And at Silmo, I'm in Hall 6. And the booth is J070. Booth J070 in Hall 6. So that's where the bulk of the collection will be shown. And then Mido next year, there'll be more new designs which are proposed. I just keep my fingers crossed that things turn up on time. Because the worst thing that happens is they bring the frames into the show on the first day, and I don't like that. I like that at all in advance. But one of the problems with factories, which luckily you guys don't get involved in, is don't worry, it'll all be ready on time. And I've never yet found the stuff ready, anything ready on time, which is quite annoying because I'm very fussy about things like that. I want everything in place before. So if there's any problems, we can sort it out before we get to the show and not have it at the show. But anyway, I can't control that, and I mustn't let myself get too aggravated about it. We release what we've got when we can, and that's it. So there are lots of shows, unfortunately, because apart from the main ones, you've got New York. We have one in London, February. There's Munich in January. There's one called 100% Optical in London in February. End of February, we've got Nido. March, there's Copenhagen Eyes in Copenhagen. And it just seems to be never ending. It's a bit like the tennis circuit. You go from one show to the next. But basically, you have to decide which shows are the most important. And for me, the most important shows are the Milan and Paris, New York and Las Vegas. They're my two most important shows. Four most important shows.
So I'm pretty sure after this interview, you're going to have a lot of new fans. What's the best way for our followers and listeners to get in touch with you?
Well, apart from finding me on social media, which is Oliver Goldsmith Spectacles, I've given you the booth stands in Las Vegas and Paris. And my email address is a very simple one because that's what I chose. It is Oliver Goldsmith, all one word, at hotmail.com. And I am online all the time, much to my family's disgust. And I always try to answer my emails within 24 hours. I never let anyone wait around, you know, because I get a lot of inquiries coming in. Where can I get this? Where can I get that? So I do answer my emails because it's very, very important to show that that I'm here. And to a lot of people, especially people who phone me, and I say, this is Oliver Goldsmith, they say, what, the Oliver Goldsmith? And yes. They say, wow, you answered the phone. I said, well, that's all customer service for you. And we're a small business with a big reputation, and I just want the public to know that I am here for them, and my work that I do is for them, because I want to make every man look handsome, confident in his glasses, and I want every woman to feel that she's wearing something which is an extension of her jewelry. Her glasses are an extension of her jewelry, because when you meet somebody in the street, you don't look at their shoes to see who they are. You look at their face. And the biggest thing on their face are the glasses. So I want women to see the glasses as jewelry, face, that's it, face jewelry. And for men, because not all men wear jewelry, face furniture.
I love it.
I feel if I've managed to get that across, then I feel I've done my job, because the whole thing of designing glasses is, as I said to you at the very beginning, elegance is the criteria. Never make a woman look stupid in glasses. And there are plenty of designs out there which make you look stupid. And that's not my scene. I don't want to do that, because my women are elegant women, and they've got to feel confident when they walk down the street, to hold their head high and be greeted. Because no one's going to come up to you and say, wow, they're horrible glasses. How did you choose those? You know, nobody says that. Especially if they're a decent friend, they won't say it. But if you're comfortable wearing them, even if they might not be right on you, doesn't matter, because you are wearing them with confidence. That's what it's all about. Don't listen to your family, your friends, or anybody else about what you should have, because in the end, you buy what they like, and it's not what you like, and it'll end up in a drawer in your bedroom, and you won't wear it and say, oh, God, that was a waste of money. Buy what you want and enjoy it, because you're wearing it.
That's just really fantastic advice. I think it's so fascinating to me, because we were talking about social media, and even though you're not actively doing the social media yourself, you live the social media before it was ever social media. You understood how to make the brand your own story, and that's why it's been so successful. So it's just fascinating to hear the story from you.
Thank you.
Okay, it's a wrap. Thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to hang out with Defocus Media. We hope something resonated with you today. Please subscribe to our podcast, and remember, we keep it 2020 around here, pun intended. We look forward to seeing you next time.